This is the current federal tax developments for April the 22nd, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're going to take a look at what's been happening in the past couple of weeks in the area of taxes, largely because I was a little bit tied up with end of tax season work. So realize we've skipped a couple of weeks. That's pretty normal for the end of tax season. Wouldn't be surprised if it happens again right around the October 15th deadline as I swap over from tax season to continuing education mode. But we'll have some updates before then, obviously, and we'll be doing a lot more of this before we get to that potential issue. So this week we're going to take a look at the IRS this year again waived the penalties for not taking distributions from certain inherited IRAs, but what they're saying this year is this is going to be the last time. They expect the regulations to go final before we have to worry about 2025. So one more chance. We'll talk about what that chance is. We'll talk about what you might want to do about take advantage of that or not take advantage of this particular option and other issues. We also had the first major update from the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network of the beneficial ownership information reporting fact, frequently asked questions, since we had last January's update. So we had a number of new updates. We'll talk about what's in there. We will go through the questions this week, the questions and answers. For the most part, I'm not going to spend time on the questions and answers directed not at reporting, but at the issues of access. That's a whole different world, and we're not worried about that on this side. First thing is, we can't do anything about it. You have to remind your clients that's not something we control. And if they want to go into that for their own reasons because they want to yell at a senator or something, that's fine. But it's not something we can control. And most of us are not in the position of being a party that is allowed to get access to that data. So I'm going to assume if you're in that group, you should be listening somewhere else. If you're in law enforcement, et cetera, about how this thing is going to work from your end. But let's move on to the IRS Notice 2024-35. This came out on April the 16th, the day after tax day, right? The IRS wanted to give us some good news to get started. And Notice 2024-35 deals with the issue that arose after the SECURE Act about what was going to happen to required minimum distributions if you inherited an IRA from an individual, either an IRA or actually a defined contribution, I'll get that right, pension plan or benefit plan, employee benefit plan, interest from somebody who died after 2019. As you may remember, under the SECURE Act, we had a special set of rules that was going to push us back to now a 10-year rule if you were a standard designated beneficiary, while if you were an eligible designated beneficiary, a much smaller subclass, you could still elect lifetime distributions, but most people had to get everything out by the end of 10 years. Now, many, many advisors assumed when they read the bill and read write-ups about the bill that the law had taken out all the old rules if you were covered by this, you were an eligible beneficiary, or a designated beneficiary, I should say, and you were just going to have 10 years, meaning that no matter how old, Harry was when he died, Harry's heirs could essentially take nothing beginning with the year after Harry died, and they continued doing that for 9 years and wait and take the entire balance of the IRA or retirement plan account in the 10th year after Harry had died. But the IRS issued proposed regulations in 2023 that indicated, or 22, I should say, that indicated that no. They said, look, the law didn't change the rule that says when you inherit a defined contribution style account, which would include an IRA, from a person who was in pay status, meaning they had already gone past their required beginning date, when they have to have taken required minimum distributions, generally was before SECURE Act, would have been April 1st of the year after you turned age 70 and a half. As we know, that age is moving all over the place now. So we'll just say they haven't reached their required beginning date, whatever that date might be. At the time they died, that because they kept in the rule that said in such a case, distributions had to continue at least as rapidly, plus had the rule that at the end of the 10th year, everything had to come out, that you had to comply with both of those. That means that you needed to take a life expectancy distribution based on the, you know, the designated beneficiary who inherited that particular account. You had to take it over their life expectancy. And again, you fix that life expectancy in the year following the year that Harry died. And then you would just subtract one from that each year through years 1 through 9 after Harry died. And then in year 10, you would have to get everything else out of there. Obviously, you can take more than required at any time you want, but you still had to meet the required distribution rules. Now, of course, that caused a lot of panic because, again, these proposed regs came out in the spring of 22. We had already gone past 2020 didn't matter because nobody had required distributions in 20. And it wouldn't have mattered anyway because somebody had to die in 20. And remember, in the year of death, we look back to the decedent's required distributions, and that has to come out regardless, and that rule never changed. So 2021 would have been the first year that we would have had required distributions under the proposed reg. But the proposed reg didn't come out until 22, after that distribution would theoretically have to have left the plan. Much panic ensued at that point because everybody went, oh, this is terrible. And a lot of people complained, comments came in on the regulations, and the IRS caught a lot of grief for this. So the IRS had previously announced that no penalties would be incurred, nor would a plan risk its qualification status if distributions had not been made in that 9-year period, during that 9-year period, for any basically account inherited by somebody where the original account owner had died after 2019, or the party that inherited the IRA or retirement account also died after 2019, you were the second or third or fourth, however many successor you were. And that was found in notices the IRS issued in 2022 and 2023, right? 2022, they waived it for the distributions in 21, which obviously was already a, you know, there wasn't a good way to fix those at that point. And as well said, we're not going to charge it for 22. Okay, they did say that it would apply and these rules would apply no earlier than 23. Go to 23, we again have issues. The Secure 2 bill passed at the end of 22, which complicated matters as well and changed required beginning dates again. So during 23, the IRS again announced that, okay, we're also not going to charge penalties and we're not going to have, say, a plan is risking its qualification by not making distributions, these sort of distributions in 23 for a individual that inherited the account from somebody that died after 2020 or 2019, I should say. So essentially, you know, we kicked it back one more year. And now this time they said, again, the rules will apply no earlier than 2024. Now, there's a lot of confusion about this, right? The problem is, I think too many people read summaries. Too many people read summaries, stories, news accounts, and don't actually read the IRS notice. In this case, it is incredibly important to read the notice. The penalty has been waived. You will not be penalized. No penalties will be imposed. Therefore, no distribution is required, right? It doesn't matter, right? It, you know, effectively, they may say, you know, the IRS says, we believe the law requires these distributions, but we are going to waive the penalty because we understand all of the people who, you know, read the law and concluded reasonably that it applied otherwise, and we'll get back to you about future years. And so they did that again in that year. Now the IRS has again done this in 24, but a bit differently. So the first key takeaway is there are no required minimum distributions. Now, again, not for everybody, right? Don't go saying nobody takes them because it's a very small group. No required distributions for a beneficiary that inherited a defined contribution style retirement plan, including an IRA, interest in that, from a decedent that died after 2019 and who had reached the required beginning date by the day they died. Got all that? Okay, that's fine for 24. However, right, the plan does not risk a qualification issue. I think that's important to understand. So if you're administering a plan for an employer and you have such people, now I'll admit, most plans I'm used to seeing that aren't small, closely held companies, they tend to try to avoid this. They kind of force money, you know, force heirs to roll to IRAs and get out of this because they don't want to be normally paying money to individuals who essentially were never employed by the company. So we see a lot of that. But those entities, if they are paying that, will not be in trouble for not having made those distributions during that 9-year period, right? You know, if we're inside that 9-year period currently, so they will not be done in 24. And also there's no excise tax, which is the, you know, the amount they're going to have for, I think it's officially, I love the wording, it's excess accumulations. But what it really means is you didn't take your required distribution. That penalty tax, which is now a 10 or 25% penalty, will also not be applied for anybody who is in this specific situation. I'm going to keep repeating it because people get confused. Again, you had to inherit a defined contribution style plan benefit. That could be from a retirement, that could be from an employee retirement plan. It was a defined contribution plan. 401k plans are defined contribution plans, kind of by definition, or an IRA, right? They don't have to take that distribution. They won't be penalized for not taking it. But again, that is only that subset. That does not mean your client who turned, you know, who's kicked past the normal retirement, their, you know, required beginning date, right? You know, is age 89. That does not mean they get to skip their distribution this year from their own retirement plan or their own IRA. That's not going to happen, right? Keep that in mind. Now, there is one big difference, though, from those other notices that we have. Previously, remember I said the 23 notice said that the rules would apply no earlier than 24. Right? Or I should say the 22 notice said they'd apply no earlier than 23. The 23 notice said just the same, basically the same, except rolled forward a year. They said the rules would apply no earlier than 24. However, this time, instead of saying that, this time the language says the IRS states that the IRS expects essentially the regulations to be in place and therefore the penalties to apply for tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2025. Now, again, that doesn't mean for sure they'll apply in 25, but it means that it is highly likely. So I think you want to advise your clients, again, they're still not fully committed, right? They still could change their mind, right? This does not by itself say you must take the distribution 25. By the way, that's how a lot of people got in trouble too. You know, even if they understood they could skip the 21 and 22 distribution, they told their clients they had to take it in 23 and they had them take it last year. And they didn't have to take it, right? The IRS came out with their notice later and, you know, and everybody screamed, they changed their mind. They did this. Why'd they do this? Et cetera, et cetera. How can they didn't change their mind. They said they weren't telling you what was going to happen. They said no earlier than doesn't mean, you know, right? You know, let's say that you're told that a building will be, you know, your building they're going to build for you will be complete no earlier than December of 24. That doesn't mean it will be complete in December of 24. It means it won't be complete in November of 24, but it might be January of 25. It could be anywhere in the future. You know, there's no commitment whatsoever there, except that we won't get it earlier than this date. And that was the same thing was happening. This time, again, now they're telegraphing, essentially, they expect the regulations to go final this year. And because of that, they expect the penalties to apply next year. So warn your clients that this is probably the last time. Also for planning, now we get back to, well, should I take the IRS up on this? You need to kind of run some numbers. There's an advantage of deferring taxes, as we know. So, you know, if I take a distribution in 24, I'm going to have to pay taxes in 24. That means assuming I have protective estimates in place, so I paid my 100%, 110% of last year's tax, that I'll pay this on April 15th next year. I can put it in that late, but I will have to pay it by then, right? While if I don't take this distribution, it will effectively be pushed into a pile of money that the distribution will come out much later. And conceivably, if they kept extending this, which it looks like they won't, but if they did, conceivably it could be till that end of the 10th year. But remember, the other problem we have is we do have a progressive tax system. So when you skip taking today and you take bigger numbers in the future, those bigger numbers could be taxed at a higher rate. There also is, as always, I always let clients tell me if this is going to happen. There's always a chance rates could go up in the future. Remember, they are scheduled to go up in 26, right? Individual rates are scheduled to go up in 26. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act only cut rates through the end of 25. And it's going to cost a lot of money with the scoring, because I just had to write an article for a state society about this area. And one of the things I looked at was the scoring, because that tells you a lot about how likely something is to be able to be extended, especially if they feel they have to offset because inflation has got to be worried about deficits. That's going to cost a lot of money. So those rates could very well go up in 26. So you have to balance that out. You have the time value of money calculation versus the higher rates. Now, again, with time value of money, it can be worth it to pay higher rates in the future if they're far enough in the future, right? That's kind of your trade-off. So you need to go back and work it, but I would tell the clients that we're going to go on the probability that beginning next year, they're going to have to start taking this money out, and it's not going to be an infinite deferral where we could wait to year 10 and then kind of run the numbers and do that. And now you want to determine, is there an advantage to taking some this year and reducing what comes out in the future, or is there too much of a disadvantage from having paid the tax early? And again, situations vary, fact patterns vary. You might know the client's going to come into a lot of money. You might know the client has a huge loss this year. So essentially, we could take the distribution and pay no tax. We would lose deferral on the gain, but then you balance those things out and see how it works. So in any event, you can start your planning now for required minimum distributions from individuals that inherited from a retirement plan, defined contribution style retirement plan account, which includes an IRA, who inherited that kind of account from a decedent that died after 2019, because that's what this specific rule applies to. Whew. Hopefully everybody got it this time. Please read the notice. It's not that long, especially if you skip the early parts to talk about the history. The actual part of this that actually does something right now is very short. Just read it. It's really helpful to read it. I'm going to tell you that for sure, so you understand what it does, because I have had to straighten people out constantly on not understanding how this worked. Okay, next up, we have, for the first time in a while, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network has gone back and updated some more frequently asked questions on their website. The update is dated April 18th. Now, if you go to their FAQ page, what you'll discover as you're there is that what I do is I just bring it up whenever they publish something new to find out what all changed. And I just do a Control F, or if you've got a Mac, Command F, and search for the date of the update. So like in this case, I search for April 18th, 2024, April space 818 comma space 2024. And if I just keep searching for that, it jumps to it. And every time it's going to jump to a question that either is a new question and answer or a revised Q&A. And they have a number of those this year, okay? This was the first update since the ones they did on January 12th. So it's been a while, right? It's basically been over 3 months since they last updated guidance there. And, as Spidell said in their email burst that they sent out, they didn't necessarily answer all the questions we wanted answered, including a big one as to, does a company that existed on January 1st, 2024, but is dissolved before January 1st, 2025, does that company have a filing obligation or not? We still don't really have an answer to that question. Whether we have to file because January 1st, 2024 is the effective date and January 1st, 2025 is just the deadline, or if what would make seem to make a whole lot more sense, because they disappeared during 24, we simply should delete them. But FinCEN's never answered that question. And the longer they go without answering it, the more you're going to be, a lot of people are going to suggesting, a lot of attorneys will end up suggesting, that you file it because the penalties for being wrong are so draconian, potentially, that you just don't want to be wrong. You know, it's the simplest approach is to file it and go that route, or at least make sure the client is the one that makes the call, right, to not file. And they understand it's against your recommendations or against the attorney's recommendations that they, you know, have not filed the report. It does add a significant number of Q&As for those who will be given access to this information. While that's an important part of the law, it's not something I'm going to worry about, because my concern in this particular area, for those of us who are CPAs, you know, or EAs, et cetera, those in tax practice, is more on the reporting side of the equation. You know, not so much law enforcement side, how they're going to use it, who gets to use it, how they have to control things, if you're in a financial institution, et cetera. If that's you, that's a whole different area, and you should seek your own specialized training there. They also, though, added or updated a number of Q&As for those who will be filing the reports. And they deal with a lot of areas, but some of the key ones are, they talk about homeowners associations. We'll talk about those. And yes, certain homeowner associations will have to file under this rule. And they talk about then, well, who are the beneficial owners? And, you know, we'll talk a little bit about that. We'll also talk about the complications for interest held by trust. This basically goes back and just repeats what we've already been told, right? We already knew from the regulations or from the rules, the final rules, about how you're supposed to look into a trust, but apparently a lot of people haven't looked there. So they've kind of got a summary now in the FAQs, but it really doesn't change anything. It just puts it out there. And then there are a few other random issues. Now, what I want to do for the rest of today's program is just point you to, and we do have them here in the slides, and therefore, if you download the slides, you know, or download the PDFs of the slides, you'll get this information. We have the Q&As, other than the access Q&As, that are in the April 18th set of modifications to the FAQs. So let's start first with question C8. This one just kind of floored me that we had to answer this, but I guess we do. Do the beneficial ownership information reporting requirements apply to S corporations? Not surprisingly, since it applies to corporations, period, it applies to S corporations, right? Yes, it's a reporting company. The fact you're an S corporation doesn't take you out of this. This is because, unfortunately, a lot of tax practitioners don't understand the difference between a legal entity and a tax status. S corporation is a tax status. It's not a legal entity. Legally, that thing is either a corporation or a limited liability company or some other thing that's being treated like an LLC under the check the box rules. But the check the box rules have no impact on this. If there is an S corp, if there's a corporation there, and I'm in Arizona, so we would find this out by looking at the Arizona Corporation Commission site. If there's a corporation there, you have to file, right? That's it. It's a covered entity unless you can qualify for an exception. If it's an LLC, similarly, which you also would, there are ways to check with the state to see if there's an LLC, if you know the name. Hopefully it's helpful you know the name. But if it was formed as an LLC, then it should. And since you have to pretty much be one of those two to be an S corporation, because that's the only way to be allowed to give that tax status, you're going to have to file otherwise. This is similar. I am somewhat surprised. I don't believe there's one in there, although now there's somebody in the FAQs who knows you lose track. But, you know, the same is true for LLCs. I don't care your disregard entity. That's a tax status, not a legal status. Legally, that LLC you formed and treat as disregarded for tax purposes is an LLC. Single member LLCs are LLCs. I don't care they're disregarded. They're LLCs, and because of that, they come under this rule by default unless you can qualify for one of the exceptions, the 26 exceptions. Okay? Legal entities, what we're worried about here, I don't care. Ignore tax elections. Tax elections are irrelevant. Okay? I am a little concerned they felt this question had to be added. I suspect that is because they keep getting this question. Yeah, does not matter. Irrelevant. Tax status is irrelevant. We are looking at legal status. Right? What is the legal status of the entity? Not what the tax status is. This is not a Title 26 United States Code issue. Therefore, Title 26 rules for the Internal Revenue Code don't apply. Okay, unless they bring them in the regs, which they do for some of the couple of the exceptions. They will reference Title 26 issues, but that's because they cross-reference them. But this is not, generally they don't apply. If a domestic corporation or LLC is not created by filing a document with the Secretary of State or similar office, is it a reporting company? And this time they kind of indicate, okay, we probably overstepped slightly in our reg. Because in the law, if they don't need to file in the, and as I said, this is a very rare case. In the very rare case, in some states, some jurisdictions, you might be able to form a corporation or an LLC without filing a document with the state, Secretary of State or similar office. For those of you in Arizona, similar office here is the Corporation Commission. If you don't file by filing with those, then you don't have a reporting obligation because the law is looking at whether you file with those entities. The regulations say that an LLC counts, period, and then find at the bottom, or any and I think it believes says any other entity that is created by filing a document with the Secretary of State or similar office. And yeah, that's why the law really just looks at those that file with a state agency. If it doesn't file with the state agency, it does not need to file a report. That's how it's doing, but that is the key. That is a legal question, right? That's not one you ask your client, right? You ask their counsel, right? Clients will swear all the time they didn't file anything with the, you know, with the state to form their LLC, and they'll be wrong in 99.9% of the cases. You know, as they say, this is an unusual circumstance. That's not going to be the norm. And if in doubt, assume they did. That's going to be the way it's going to work. Again, I remember a quote from, I believe it was Burgess Raby, attorney here, years ago, about the best place to hide something from Treasury is to file it with them, because they'll never find it. You ever been through an IRS exam, the first thing the agent asks for is a copy of the return that they're supposedly examining, that they apparently supposed to have looked at, right? The IRS looked at in order to choose them for exam. So yeah, it's a great place to hide things from the Treasury. Okay, are homeowner associations reporting companies? And this has, now see, it's not a tax issue, Title 26, but it turns out that the answer to every tax question also applies outside of tax sometimes, and that's clear here. The answer, it depends. The problem is we're looking at legal structures. An HOA can take different corporate forms. So with any entity, if an HOA was not created by filing a document with Secretary of State or office, then it's not a reporting company. An incorporated HOA or other HOAs created by filing such a filing may also qualify for an exemption. Okay, so remember, there are two ways in here. If your HOA is a corporation, it's in. However, it can qualify for an exemption if it is currently being treated as a 501c4 social welfare organization, then it's going to qualify as a tax-exempt entity, right, if it's filing under that status. If it's not a designated 501c4 organization, it, you know, it may fall within the reporting company definition and be required to report BOI to FinCEN, right? This is one of the key issues. So again, it depends. Those of you who do HOA reporting, you'll understand the intricacies and the options for HOA reporting and whether they'll be treated as an exempt org or not, various other options. But as they say, a lot of HOAs are going to have to file this particular issue, which leads to the next question at D13. Who is a beneficial owner of a homeowner association? Also an answer added. Now, an HOA that has to file, right, does not qualify for an exemption, has to report its beneficial owners. Obvious question is, who are they? Now, as noted, standard definition still applies. Any individual who directly or indirectly exercises substantial controls over the company or owns or controls at least 25% of the ownership interest. Now, this is where it gets a little more interesting. In a lot of HOAs, like, you know, the HOA for my, you know, covers, what is it, 34 different basically, you know, living areas. And nobody owns more than a quarter of those, right? In theory, our ownership in the HOA is based upon how many units we own. So in a lot of cases, you know, no individual owns or controls at least 25% of the ownership interest, right? So if you had an HOA that was, let's say, 100 units, you know, you need somebody to own 25, basically owns at least 25 of the 100. And if there's nobody that owns 25 of the 100, they're not accumulating a bunch of these, then you won't have an ownership control, most likely. You could through related and other weird structures, but we'll assume in most cases, I'm going to think you won't in most standard HOAs. You know, if nobody does, however, FinCEN expects at least one individual has to exercise substantial control. Remember, that's a second way in. If you exercise substantial control over the reporting company, if you meet any of the following criteria, you're considered to exercise substantial control. If you are a senior officer, so the officers of the HOA, president, you know, secretary, right, treasurer, you know, those kind of standard designated officers, which are like the equivalent of CEO or president, right, various other things, they're going to be considered beneficial owners. Their data needs to be reported to FinCEN. And we have to worry about if their address changes. I guess the good news is in a lot of these cases, if they're actually living in their property, if their address changes, they probably have to leave the board, right? Because they're no longer there. They sold the property. But anyway, that'd be a change. If an individual has the authority to appoint or remove certain officers or majority of the directors of the HOA, if you have that kind of odd structure, somebody can do that. They have enough authority to do it. Then that will go. The individual is an important decision maker. Now, that's an odd definition. And you have to decide what that means, but who's really making the calls for this organization. Or if they have any other form of substantial control. Again, we're kind of back to it depends, which I realize you don't like as an answer. But that is the answer that we're stuck with. It depends, right? The next question, D14. Can beneficial owners own or control reporting companies through trust? Now, this actually is covered in the final rules, right? The answers here are not really surprising to anybody that's gone through the final rules, but let's walk through them because, again, it appears a lot of people are asking questions, right? And they're not reading the final rules, which I strongly suggest you read. Remember, the final rules are binding on FinCEN, right? This is advisory. We don't know how much authority this is going to carry. Probably the courts will pay a lot of attention to the FAQs, right? And certainly if FinCEN tries to penalize somebody for doing something the FAQ said they could do, I suspect the court will be very, shall we say, skeptical. But make sure you look at the actual rule because that's really the binding guidance here. So yes, beneficial owners can very well own or control a reporting company through trust. They can do so either by exercising substantial control through a trust arrangement, or by, owning or controlling the ownership interests of reporting companies that are held in a trust, right? A beneficial owner for this purpose, you know, so who are those beneficial owners? You're exercising substantial control, and this is question D15, for reporting company or owning control at least 25%. Exercising substantial control or owning controlling company ownership interests may be direct or indirect, including any contract arrangement, understanding, relationship, or otherwise, and that includes doing it via a trust. No question, that's there. Trust arrangements vary. Now, this is where I've recommended. When the trust starts getting at all messy, you really need to bring in legal counsel to interpret the powers and decide who fits which category. It is very easy to get a very complicated situation with a trust where it's going to be interesting making a call as to are there beneficial owners when we look through into this trust. Particular facts and circumstances determining whether specific trustees, beneficiaries, grantors, settlors, and other individuals with a role in a particular trust or beneficial owners of a reporting company whose ownership interests are held through that trust. And we continue. For instance, the trustee of a trustee, beneficial owner of a reporting company, either by exercising substantial control of the reporting company or by owning or controlling at least 25% of the ownership interest of the company through a trust or similar arrangement. And it also could go down to certain beneficiaries, grantors, or settlors may also own or control ownership interests in a reporting company through a trust. Now, straight from the regulations, they say the following conditions indicate that ownership, an individual owns or controls ownership interests in a reporting company through a trust. Their trustee or an area individual has the authority to dispose of trust assets. If the trustee could dispose of trust assets, which generally they can, that's going to automatically make them, you know, a potential, beneficial owner if the trust has more than 25% of the interest in the company, right? That would do it, right? A beneficiary who is the sole permissible recipient of income and principal from the trust, whereas the right to demand distribution or withdrawal substantially all assets from the trust. So, for instance, the first part of that clause, think about a qualified subchapter S beneficiary, a Q-sub. If you have a trust that makes a Q-sub election, that beneficiary is the sole permissible recipient of income or principal from that trust, if that's the only asset in the trust. So because they have that sole authority, because they have the sole permissible recipient, they're going to be deemed to own the shares of the S corporation that the trust owns. And if that's more than 25%, they would be a beneficial owner. The right to demand distribution or withdraw substantial assets from the trust, that's going to bring in most, self-settled trusts where they're still the beneficiary, or even some trusts where, you know, they give the beneficiary the right to make that demand. So they inherited the property, but they could demand assets. Now, normally that's not there because kind of really causes issues with liability protection. But still, you know, that's going to be there. Or the grantor or settlor has the right to revoke the trust or otherwise withdraw the assets of the trust. That category is going to cover almost every, standard revocable living trust. They're going to be covered by that rule, okay? Now, this is not an exhaustive list of conditions where you could be a beneficial owner. Facts are saying there may be other arrangements through which individuals associated with the trust may be beneficial owners of the trust that holds interest. That's why I'm suggesting seek legal counsel. You need to understand all the powers, and somebody needs to think through, are these sufficient to grant them substantial control or effective ownership of whatever interest the trust owns? And then you got to kind of combine that with interest they might directly control, because that's also part of that whole beneficial ownership issue. How is a reporting company's question D16 report a corporate trustee as beneficial owner? Now, this is a question that is not really covered in the regs. And I've had this question a lot. You know, they say, well, look, the trustee of this trust is, you know, First National Bank of, you know, Topeka. Now, there is a First National Bank of Topeka, but let's assume there is. Well, you know, how in the world do we report that? They're the corporate trustee, but this trust controls 60% of the stock. So how are we going to report this thing? So like they say, for these purposes, a corporate trustee means a legal entity or an individual exercising the power of a trustee in a trust arrangement. So that could also include an LLC, et cetera, any sort of legal entity, right? It's not an individual. If the reporting company's ownership interests are owned or controlled through a trust or trust through a trust arrangement with the corporate trustee, the reporting company should determine whether any of the corporate trustees in the individual beneficial owners owner control at least 25% of the ownership interest of the reporting company through their ownership interest in the corporate trustee. Now, why that's important is because of this indirect. Let's say the First National Bank of Topeka is all owned by one person. So they have 100% of the interest in the bank or in the trust company, whatever. 100% of it. Well, that means that, in essence, now they own enough of that they could be attributed more than 25% of the stock of any trust that the First National Bank of Topeka is basically the trustee of, right? Because the example here, if let's say an individual owns 60% of the corporate trustee of the trust, so we have a 60% owner of the First National Bank of Topeka, right? And that trust holds 50% of the reporting company's ownership interest. So the ABC Trust owns 50% of X, right? And Joe owns 60% of the stock of the First National Bank of Topeka. So we multiply the 60% interest that Joe has in the First National Bank of Topeka by the 50% interest the trust owns, and Joe is attributed to own 30% of X. And that's not what, and when I use X, I'm using it as a placeholder. I do not mean the entity formerly known as Twitter. So Elon, if you're listening, I don't mean you, right? So we'll keep it that way, right? I'm just using that as an example. Probably a bad letter to have chosen. And suddenly this whole thing, after I said it, I go, and I wonder, hey, wait, there is something called X now. So anyway, if that happens, then, you know, you own 30%. So you would have to report yourself as a beneficial owner of that outside company. Let's say that X changed its name to Y so that Elon's company could call itself X. So you're deemed to own 30% of Y. So, you know, you're a beneficial owner of Y. Even though your only relationship is owning 60% of the bank of the trust, and you have nothing to do with administering or handling that trust. But because you could exercise control, because you control the trustee, and because through control of the trustee, you effectively could control who the trust officer would be, right? You'd have to basically potentially change the, modify the board for the bank. So, you know, elect the right board members to the bank and have them appoint officers who then would perhaps even you as an officer who would then follow, you know, and appoint a trust officer and do whatever you wanted. Because that potential control is there, the fact that you have a effective 30% control of the entity that is in that trust means that you have to report. So all your information goes in. By contrast, if the same trust only holds 30% of the reporting company ownership interest, so only 30% of Y stock is held by the First National Bank of Topeka, then we multiply 30 by 60, and that's 18%. Now Joe does not have a 25% indirect ownership interest in Y. Because of that, Joe will not be a beneficial owner of Y unless Joe separately exercises substantial control over Y. That'll be the backdoor way you could do it. The reporting company may, but is not required to, report the name of the corporate trustee in lieu of information about individual beneficial owner only if all the following three conditions are met. So Joe can keep his information out of there if the corporate trustee is an entity that is itself exempt from the reporting requirements. So First National Bank of Topeka has to be exempt from the reporting requirements. A lot of banks are, so they could come out. The individual beneficial owner owns or controls at least 25% of the ownership interest in the reporting company by virtue of ownership interest in the corporate trustee, and the individual beneficial owner does not exercise substantial control of the reporting company. So bottom line, if the trustee itself meets an exemption, is exempt from the reporting requirements, then basically, you can ignore reporting the indirect ownership via ownership of shares in the trustee, as long as you report the name of that company, and also you report, those individuals don't otherwise exercise control, because obviously that's another way in, to exercise control. In addition to considering whether the beneficial owners or corporate trustee own or control the ownership interest of a reporting company, it may be necessary to consider whether any owners of or individuals employed by or engaged by the corporate trustee exercise substantial control. And these are the same factors we use otherwise to find individuals that exercise substantial control. Remember, they don't have to have any ownership interest to exercise substantial control as long as they get into that background, right? And they do tell you to go see the Small Entity Compliance Guide, What is Substantial Control, Chapter 2.1, to discuss how that works. Okay. F12, what address should a reporting company report if it lacks principal place of business in the United States? So if you got a foreign entity and you're trying to make this work, if the reporting company does not have principal place of business in the United States, and the company must report to FinCEN as its address, the primary location U.S. where it conducts business. If the reporting company has no principal place of business in the U.S., conducts business at more than one location in the U.S., then the reporting company may report as its primary location the address of any of those locations where the reporting company receives important correspondence. If it has no principal place of business in the United States and does not conduct business functions at any location in the U.S., then its principal primary location in the U.S. is the address of the person that the reporting company, under state or other applicable law, has designated to receive service in Arizona, the statutory agent of legal process on their behalf, right? And they do mention in some jurisdictions like Arizona, they're referred to as company's registered agent, or the address is referred to as registered office. You report that address to FinCEN, okay? That's where that one would go if you meet all of those criterias. Now, this one, when people started reading this one, it was like, hey, we're going to find the answer. One, the company was created to register before January 1st and was, and they start, hey, and then they say, go away 425, so I'm going to talk about here. Was exempt from the reporting requirements, loses an exempt status between January 1st, 24 and January 1st, 25. How long does it have to file the initial report? This was not answered in the regs. And the problem is, remember, if I come to January 1st, 2024, and I don't meet an exception, right? Then I have until January 1st, 2025 to file. But otherwise, if my status changes under the updated report rules or the initial report rules, after January 1st of 24, does that count like I got formed on that date? And do I have only 30 days to report the fact I exist, the fact that I now have to report? And this is what they said. A company that loses exempt status must file the report with FinCEN within 30 calendar days after the date it no longer meets the criteria for an exemption. A reporting company created to register to do business before January 1st, 2024, however, has until January 1st, 2025 to file its initial report. Therein our problem. What do we do when we were exempt on January 1st, 24, but we lose that exemption before January 1st of 25? FinCEN has determined that if you were exempt and you existed before 24 and you lose that exemption in 24, you can file by the later of the remaining days left in the one-year filing period, which means January 1st, 2025, or 30 days after you lost your exempt status. So, for example, if you have a company that an existing reporting company ceases to be exempt on February 1st of 24, it can wait till January 1st of 25 to file its initial report. If the company ceases to be exempt on December 15th, 24, then it will have until January 14th of 25. It won't have to file on January 1st. They'll give you that few extra days to make that filing in that fact pattern. I don't expect, there are going to be companies that have this happen, but you know, if you do, these are how the rules work. What penalties do you face for violating requirements? This is just an updated question because they put in, as we've told you in an earlier broadcast, this penalty is inflation adjusted. And it was inflation adjusted going back to when it was first enacted, which was at the very end of 2000. So the number is not 500 per day, it's 591 per day. That's really the only change they have in the penalties question is they talk about the inflation adjustment numbers. Okay. If the size reporting company fluctuates above and below one of the thresholds for the large reporting company, does it need to file a BOI report? We kind of knew the answer to this was yes, and yeah, the answer is. You need to file, you don't otherwise meet. If you lose an exemption, you got to file. If it has never filed before because it was exempt on January 1st of 24, it would file as a newly exempt entity. Noting it's now exempt. If a later date, you no longer meet the criteria. So let's say you started out, you weren't exempt. So you file by January 1st, 25. Now you qualify for the exemption later. Now you file within 30 days of becoming aware you now qualify for an exemption. You file and say, we no longer have to report. If you then later lose that status again, so you're now no longer exempt, then you're going to have 30 days to update them and say, hey, we need to come back in now. So again, there is that weird, you know, if you hit January 1st, 24 and you were exempt, then if you become non-exempt, that's an initial report. But if you file your initial report, because let's say you weren't exempt on January 1st of 2024, so you file that by January 1st, 25, and then in 2026 you become exempt, or you lose the exemption, right? Then in 26, you have to file initial, right? So it's a little bit weird how that goes on, but that's kind of the structure we knew we had for quite a while. And they remind you, you've got to have 20 full-time employees in the United States, must file for income tax or information return in the previous year, demonstrating more than 5 million gross receipts or sales, and have to have an operating presence and office in the U.S. to meet the large company exception. What's going to happen is you're either going to have employees drop below the 20 employee category, or you're going to have the revenue drop below the 5 million. So you're going to come in and out of exempt status, which is, you know, one of our key problems that we have going forward, right? So yeah, it is one of those things. This has been the update here for the week of April the 22nd, 2024. Hopefully you're now back. We'll keep this up to date and keep things going every week. If you have any questions, my email address, edzollers@currentfulltaxfilmos.com. I also watch the Connect sites run by certain state CPA societies I'm a member of. That includes Arizona, Illinois, New Jersey, Minnesota, and Idaho, right? Got all those. And Washington, yeah, in that mix. So if you're a member of one of those, you can post there. And if I see your question, I'll see if I can help in answering. Otherwise, we hope to see you back here next week when we'll talk about whatever new is happening in current federal tax developments.